It was self-reliant lads like this who walked over the hills from all parts of Scotland to the ancient kingdom of Fife, where at the eastern edge beside the North Sea the premier university of Scotland stood. Glasgow's was bigger, Edinburgh's more notable, Aberdeen's the most scholarly. But St. Andrew's was the peer, the heart and soul of both Scottish history and the Presbyterian faith. It was a noble university, gray and quiet in outward appearance, vital and throbbing with intellectual intensity. Sometimes it seemed as if the preachers of half the Protestant world had come from this devoted town by the bitterly cold sea, where the warmth of theological disputation often compensated for the rawness of the climate. During his 13th year, Finlay MacNab studied with Owen MacRae, the tutor to whom Ninian Gow had recommended him. He lived with this penurious man and shared his meager table, at which, after the so-called meals had ended, he would pore over his Greek, his moral philosophy, and his figures. But in the early mornings, when he and his tutor took their walk before breakfast, he would observe the glory of St. Andrew's, for, in obedience to a very ancient tradition, its students wore bright red gowns, never black until they had acquired degrees, so that the town seemed filled with brightly moving flowers, hurrying this way and that, a blaze of red gowns darting into doorways. At age 14, Finlay was incorporated to the Leonardine College of the University, and the principal of the college asked the young man to meet with him. "MacNab, I've good reports of your seriousness. I do hope you'll be studying for the ministry." "I have no call to the pulpit," Finlay said honestly. "Then avoid it by all means, but make yourself a scholar." "With help, I shall," Finlay said. During his entire stay at the university, he would not see his grandparents, or his dog, or the lovely shadows of Glenlyon. He continued to live with his first tutor, and to share the miserable meals. But now he was entitled to wear the famous red gown and cherish this badge of scholarly fellowship. But at the beginning of his third year, a totally unexpected transformation took place, as he explained to his tutor. "I find I am not suited for the higher learning." "You're a true scholar." "I no longer like the university. My mind runs to the moors, to action, to trading cattle at the Falkirk Tryst." "I must summon the medics. You're sick." He was not. His mind was clear, and it was delivering a masterful image of the kind of man he was intended to be. One who acted, one who dared to take risks, one who loved the hurly-burly of the tryst. Firmly, he told his tutor, "I am ill-fitted to be a scholar. I shall go home." At this moment of confusion, he was visited by a man he had not expected to see again, Ninian Gow, who had been summoned back to the university to occupy a chair of some importance. Unaware of the agitation which had beset his young friend, he resumed conversation as if no change had taken place. "Well, Finlay, what shall you do now that you're on your way to becoming a verified scholar?" "The world has gone topsy-turvy, Master Gow." "What could you mean?" the new professor asked. And in a burst of words, Finlay revealed recent developments. Gow, sensitive to such matters, allowed the torrent to flood along, then said quietly, "God has instituted this confusion because he has extraordinary plans for you." "What?" "He wants you to do his work in Ireland." "I know nothing of Ireland." "God wants you to remain here at St. Andrew's 3 more years, make yourself into a devout clergyman, then sail across the Irish Sea and save that benighted country." "That I cannot do." At age 17, Finlay was a well-organized, stubborn-minded young man, able beyond his years and of firm convictions. He was devout, convinced that John Knox had been correct in leading the way to Protestantism, and totally satisfied that Presbyterianism was the Lord's chosen instrument for the salvation of the human race, especially the Scottish. But he did not want to become a clergyman, for substantial reasons which he now revealed. I could never be a saintly man. When one of the Campbells took away two of my cattle, I wanted to kill him, and would have had I not been stopped. Campbells deserve punishment, Gow said, but not killing. And when I walk through the shops, I like to stare at the pretty girls. Clergymen do the same. They marry. But I have not the inner calling. Gow studied this solemn declaration for some moments, then said, with that generosity of spirit which would make him a notable professor, next at Glasgow and finally at Oxford, God summons us in different ways. He doesn't require you to become one of his ministers, or even to finish university. Come with me, and remind yourself as to what service is. They walked to that sacred spot where Patrick Hamilton, born a Catholic but inspired by the Reformed teachings of John Knox, had been burned at the stake by the local Catholics. Finlay, he refused to recant even when they piled more faggots at his feet. He was an enemy of popery, and so must you be. And beside the reddish stones which marked where Hamilton had died, Gow told of Ireland's problems. We have planted, successfully I'm sure, a mustard seed in the northern counties. Trusted Scotsmen by the score cross the Irish Sea to protect the land we've won and to advance Presbyterianism against the onslaughts of popery. What could I do? Finlay asked. And Gow said, There is a need for husbandmen, for fine merchants, for anyone who will help strengthen Protestant roots in that ill-fated land. That's the kind of work I'd be fitted for, Finlay said. And some days later, when Gow brought him the news that a Scottish landowner in Northern Ireland, a trusted Presbyterian, was seeking a man who understood cattle and horses to serve as factor on his estates, Finlay volunteered for the job. After submitting glowing testificates penned by Gow, by his longtime tutor MacRae, and by the principal of St. Andrews, he received from across the Irish Sea the exciting news that he had been selected. When he bade farewell to Professor Gow, he said apologetically, My life was changed at Falkirk Tryst. I discovered that I belong with the sweating merchants, the mountebanks. When Gow indicated that he understood, the young man added, And the swirling petticoats of the dancing girls. When a man once has the Latin, he can never be completely lost. God will find you proper work to do. With little regret, Finlay MacNab laid aside forever the good red gown of St. Andrews, unmatched in all the universities of the world, and set forth, like many another Scottish young man before him, to walk across Scotland and say farewell to the lone cottage at the head of his glen. But when he reached it, he found it occupied by a different set of MacNabs, for his grandfather and grandmother were recently dead, and even his dog Rob was missing. "Did you ever know a dog named Rob?" Finlay asked. And when the new MacNabs said no, he stood mournfully by the rough-walled cottage, tested the ropes that kept the thatched roof intact, and lamented the passage of the simple glories he had known here and would know no more. Adjusting his kilt, he started for that exquisite chain of western glens which would take him down to Glasgow, where he would be looking for a boat to Ireland. As he began the journey that would ultimately lead him to Texas, Finlay was 18, of average height, weighing 11 stone 4. He came from a line of men who had defended their rights in battle. He was himself a skilled cattle thief, a good man with the claymore, and one who loved the conviviality of his fellows. He had three fundamental characteristics which determined his behavior. He was a fierce Protestant, whose ancestors had defended this religion with their lives. He had a stubborn sense of honor, which lay quiescent when respected, but flared into the wildest self-defense when insulted or transgressed. And he had a passionate love of freedom, which his people in the glen had sustained against Campbells and the English kings. Everything he had experienced, the lessons of Greek and Roman history, the accounts of his own clan, the records of his Scottish church, the works of the great philosophers, had instilled in him an almost fanatical dedication to liberty, which he would not surrender easily. He was, in short, one of the finest young men his world was then producing. And there were other freedom seekers like him, arising in France, in England, and in Germany. But the most able pool of emigrating talent was developing within that intrusive Presbyterian enclave in Northern Ireland, where, in obedience to the thrust of history, many young people were trending toward Texas, without ever realizing they were headed that way. When they arrived, they would prove a most difficult group to discipline, especially when the center of political control lay far distant in Mexico City, manned by persons of a different culture, contemptuous of their aspirations. Finley's employer in Ireland was a big, rugged man with the reassuring Scottish name of Angus MacGregor, whose ancestors had received assistance from the Crown in London in putting together, halfway between the towns of Lurgan and Portadown, southwest of Belfast, a tremendous holding of spacious fields reaching all the way to Lochnay. It was on this estate that Finlay entered upon his duties. "Young man, you're to make my herds prosper, trade my horses profitably, and keep the damn papists in line." When the first MacGregor had come as a stranger to these lands, the population had been 92% Catholic. By the time he died, it was down to half. When the present MacGregor inherited, his occupying farmers were about 40% Catholic, and now they were no more than 18%. In this orderly, irresistible manner, the lush green fields of Northern Ireland were being rescued from popery, and after Finlay MacNab had been factor for a while, he could boast, "All my drovers are now trusted men from Scotland, loyal Highlanders who speak our tongue." These invaders became known as the Scots-Irish, which signified that in heritage, religion, and firmness of character they were Scots, while in terrain and culture they were Irish. It was a powerful mix, this blending of two disparate Celtic strains, and they might more properly have been called Celts, for that is what they were. Dreamers, wild talkers, men of dour concentration when needed, and great colonizers. The free-living local Celts exerted a powerful negative influence on young Finlay, but they taught him the pleasures of good Irish whiskey and the joy of teasing the local lassies, two occupations which delighted him, but which also plunged him into serious trouble. One morning, after being unable to remember how the preceding night had ended, he looked at himself ruefully and mumbled, "I've made a far journey from St. Andrews," and he was pleased that Professor Gow could not see him now. In 1810, at the age of 18, he found himself involved in two situations from which there could only be one escape. He had fallen in love with the daughter of a Lurgan squire, and he coveted the jet-black mare of a Portadown butcher. The squire would not surrender his daughter to a lad who seemed bent on becoming a rascal, and the butcher would not sell his mare to a young fellow unable to pay a decent price. Young Finlay resolved the dilemma neatly. He stole both the girl and the mare, and after placing the former astride the latter, he led a merry chase over the fields and roads of Northern Ireland. In the end, he abandoned both the girl and the mare, who were restored to their rightful owners, while he, always a jump ahead of his pursuers, made his way secretly to Dublin, where he caught a freight boat to Bristol in England, on the safe side of the Irish Sea. Unable to find work, he resorted to his traditional occupation of cattle stealing, only to discover that in England this had never been a game. When he returned to his lodgings one evening with a fine cow, his landlord whispered, "They're after you, Finlay, and if they catch you, it's the gibbet." Finlay suspected that this might be an evil trick whereby the landlord hoped to get the cow for nothing. But he hid in a grove of trees just in case the constables really did come. And when he saw three of them snooping about, He scurried down lanes and through alleyways till he reached the Bristol docks. Leaping aboard the first ship available, he found himself, by ironic chance, headed for America's most Catholic city, Baltimore. In 1812, at the age of 20, he arrived in America just in time to become involved in the war starting that year. But after trying to decide whether he was an American patriot or a British partisan, he concluded that he was neither and offered himself to both sides, providing each with horses, cows, pigs, sheep, and goats. By 1820, when he was well established in Baltimore, whose German citizens liked to do business with him, his careless dalliance with Bertha Keller, daughter of a Munich baker, obligated him to marry much sooner than he had intended. Bertha was a hefty, blonde young woman he would never normally have chosen. But when his father-in-law died in 1824, McNab found himself proprietor of a flourishing bakery, which he quickly enlarged into a ship's chandlery of impressive dimensions. He liked working on the beautiful Baltimore waterfront, and was on his way to becoming a man of some importance, with a stodgy wife and three flaxen-haired children, when the inherited McNab tendency surfaced. For in 1827, he was detected in a most nefarious transaction involving cattle owned by neighboring Germans. With no alternative but a term in jail, he decided to leave town. When his complaining wife, disgusted with his irresponsible behavior, refused to accompany him on his flight, he was rather relieved, for she had proved an irritable woman, and he was glad to be shed of her. Leaving his two daughters with their mother, he kept his son, Otto, slipped out of Baltimore before the enraged cattle owners could pounce upon him, and headed for the national road leading west. They were nearly 80 miles out of Baltimore, approaching Hagerstown, when young Otto gained his first insight into the nature of this trip, and indeed his first childish glimpse into the structure of life itself. Although not yet 6, he was a precocious lad who suspected that he and his father were leaving his mother for good, and this caused pain. He knew that where his father was involved, his mother had been a bossy woman. But with Otto, she had been a loving protector, standing always as his principal support, and he missed her. Often in the morning he expected to see her coming toward him with a bowl of porridge, or at night with hot sausages. He was so confused in his loneliness that sometimes he wanted to cry, but his stern heritage, half dour Scot, half stubborn German, plus a warning look from his father, forced him to bite his lip and march resolutely ahead. But at dusk, when he crawled beneath his blanket, he did not try to hide the fact that he was miserable. But he felt no uncertainty about traveling with his father, and even though he did not fully understand why Findlay had fled Baltimore in such a hurry, he was sure that no blame fell on his father. A perplexed little boy, he stepped forth boldly each morning as they probed into the wilderness. One evening, as they plodded along the ill-kept road, trying to decide where to spread their thin blankets for the night, Otto saw through the growing darkness a light that shone from the window of some cabin situated well off the road. And the little hut seemed so established, so different from the wandering life he was leading, that an overwhelming hunger assailed him. "Papa, let's stop here." "No, we'll find a valley before real darkness." "But, Papa, the light." "On ahead." They kept to the road, this stubborn father and his son nearing 6, and it was then that the little boy fixed in his mind the image which would live with him for the rest of his life. A cabin secure in the wilderness, a light shining from the window, refuge from the lonely, shadow-filled road. And it was also then, because of the way in which his father urged him to move on, that he first suspected that he would not be allowed to share in that forbidden warmth, at least never for long. And whenever afterward he saw such lights at night, his heart hesitated, for he knew what they symbolized. 25 miles west of Hagerstown, the McNabs had to make a crucial decision. For there, a path deviated to the north, heading over the hills to Pittsburgh, an enticing target. "Is it true?" Finley asked a traveler as they stood at the junction. "Do boats with steam engines leave Pittsburgh and run all the way to New Orleans?" "They do," the stranger assured him. "But you'd be wise to beware of them." "Why?" "For 3 solid reasons," he said. "They're very expensive and would eat up your savings. They're very dangerous, for they blow up constantly. And the criminals who sail them will steal what money you have left, cut your throat, and toss you overboard. Stay clear of those boats at Pittsburgh." Finley accepted this advice, but the more young Otto thought about the mysterious boats of steam that wandered down 1,000 miles of river, the more obsessed he became with them, and he pestered his father, "Let's go to Pittsburgh. Let's take a boat. I'm tired of walking." And when Finley reminded him of the dangers the traveler had pointed out, Otto said pleadingly, "But you would know how to fight those bad men." "There's the money, too. We'll need all we have when we get to Cincinnati." With a melancholy the boy would never forget, the McNabs rejected the steamboats and continued their way to Morgantown and on to Parkersburg, where at last they would join the Ohio River, along whose grassy banks they would walk the last 300 miles to Cincinnati. Otto was a thin, wiry lad, who looked as if he might not grow into a tall or robust man. But he displayed, even at this untested age, a cool efficiency and a stubborn determination. He intended one day to sail down the river aboard a steam vessel, and as he walked, he remained constantly aware that off to his right, somewhere, lay the great river, and he could imagine himself breaking away from his father, heading north and finding it. He was satisfied that if he ever did so, some boat would see him, stop, and pick him off the bank. He was lost in such romantic thoughts one morning when he let out a gasp which seemed to come from deep within, as if his heart had been touched. "Oh, Papa!" For there, in full majesty, rode the Ohio River, highway of the nation, bringer of good things to alien parts. Much bigger than he had imagined, more sinisterly dark, in its motion it bespoke its power and the fact that anyone who ventured upon it would be carried to strange and magnificent places like Cincinnati, Louisville, and Paducah. "Papa, look!" From the opposite shore, a small craft had set out, obviously intending to cross to where the McNabs waited, and Finley told his son, "That's a ferry. It'll come to our side and carry us across." "We ride on it?" the boy cried with delight. And when another traveler said, "We sure do, sonny," Otto kept his eyes riveted to this reassuring sight. But as he waited for the little ferry to cross the river, he became aware that something of magnitude was approaching from the right. And just in time, he turned to catch the majestic approach of a large river steamer. Belching smoke, its great paddles churning the water, it was a thrilling sight. Well-to-do passengers lined its 2 tiers, their fine clothes enhancing its magnificence. It was the climax out of Paducah, one of that grand adventurous fleet, which had started under the imaginative command of Nicholas Roosevelt in 1811 to bring steam navigation to the network of great rivers that bound the central areas of America together. "Oh, Papa," Otto cried as the lovely boat passed, for he had seen his first riverboat, and it had captured him. On the ferry they crossed into Ohio, then followed country roads along the right bank of the river as it wound its way from Parkersburg through the empty wastes of southernmost Ohio and on to Portsmouth, where the Scioto River joins the Ohio. It was a journey of compelling beauty. The vistas changed constantly. At night, solitary lights glowed on the opposite shore, indicating where some adventurous soul from settled Virginia had decided to test the wilderness in Kentucky. Deer accompanied the travelers, and one evening a small bear approached their sleeping place when Finley was absent gathering sticks for a fire. Otto, who had never faced such an adversary before, hesitated for one frightened moment. Then, realizing instinctively that he must protect their belongings, he grabbed the nearest piece of wood and made right for the beast. Thrashing about with his little club, he bewildered the bear, but not for long. With a sweep of its paw, the animal pushed the boy away, nudging him into a thicket. Astonished at the insolence of the beast, Otto first shook his head, then glared at the animal. With a grunt to give him courage, he fought his way out of the brush, uttered a furious yell, and charged back at the little bear, who was now rummaging among the McNab possessions. Otto was prepared to do battle by himself, but his father, hearing the commotion, hurried back. Otto, no. The warning was ineffective, for Otto was outraged by the brusque treatment the bear had handed him, and was determined to drive the creature away. But before he could resume his assault, Finley rushed up, and with a much larger stick belabored the animal, who growled, studied his adversaries, and rumbled off. Trembling, Finley sat with his son beside the river, and there they remained as the long twilight waned. "You were very brave," Finley said. "I'm proud of you." "He was stealing our food." "Never tangle with a bear." "But it was only a little one." "A bear's a bear, son. Don't ever tangle with one." "But you did, Papa." Finley could think of a dozen appropriate fatherly warnings. "Yes, but I'm a grown man." Or, "You're lucky it was a little bear." Or, "If you have to fight a bear, don't use a stick, get a gun." He stifled such admonition, for he believed that his son's action had been proper. Once allow a boy to run away from a serious challenge, he could continue to do so through life. Softly, he said, as if Otto were his own age, "You were right, son. If you start to do something, keep going and finish the job." They followed the good road along the Ohio right into Cincinnati, a growing town of more than 20,000, where a few resolute Germans were already establishing firms to serve the various needs of the steamboats plying up and down the river. Three ferries crossed the river to service the citizens in Kentucky, and after several exciting days, Otto told his father, "This is better than Baltimore." In many ways, the little boy talked and acted like a grown man. As frontier boys did, he was skipping a whole decade of his growing up. He was already a mature young fellow who had walked 600 miles through the wilderness and fought his bear. He knew what loneliness was and how a great river served people. Because of his waterfront experience in Baltimore, Findlay had no trouble finding a job with a German merchant who needed his expertise in buying cattle and hogs for the river traffic. And in pursuit of this work, he often visited the glamorous steamboats that docked at Cincinnati. Aboard these craft, he heard for the first time about the real wonders of the river. New Orleans, finest city in America. Them Creole girls, them great eatin' houses. At the age of 7, Otto began running errands for his father, learning the names of the steamboats and their home ports, and in doing so, he fell under the spell of a river town much different from New Orleans. He first heard of it from a tall, bearded boatman with a poetic touch. "Tell you what, sonny, when you ship down the Mississippi, as you surely will, the place you want to see is not New Orleans. The real spot is Natchez under the Hill." "That's a funny name." "It's a golden name, like out of one of the Greek fables, like maybe the gods put it there to test men." He spoke with such music and strength that Otto leaned forward to catch his words, and as the man continued, he became not an ordinary roustabout, but a chronicler. "To make things flower perfect, The gods built Natchez atop the hill, with gleaming white houses and pillared porches and a score of slaves to keep things clean. That's rich folks' country, and river folks like you and me, we ain't allowed up there. For us, the gods built Natchez under the hill, about the finest little spot in America. Aware that he had caught Otto's attention, he moved his hands in ominous gestures to indicate knives and daggers and pistols and gallows rope. A man don't watch out, they knife him. At night you hear screams, somebody's being murdered. You hear a splash, there goes a corpse into the Mississippi. Men walk bent over, they're smugglers. In the saloons you can get Tennessee whiskey, rots your gut, or a bullet ends your gut. And there are girls, and dancing through the night. Otto missed not a word of this report, but the riverman would have been astounded had he known the impact his words were having on this flaxen-haired lad. But in succeeding days, when Otto heard more about Under the Hill, and when he had time to weigh exactly what had been said, discarding the poetry, he was wise enough, even as a boy, to conclude that the lower Natchez was a sorry place, frequented by men and women of a low degree. He could not have explained why he was reaching this conclusion, or what it signified, but he was developing a powerful rejection of goings-on. He was becoming a youthful conservative, in the best sense of that word, who deplored gambling, knifing, girls who danced all night, and general irresponsibility. He opposed them all. His father was also hearing a new word, one that would exert an equal influence on his life. Because Cincinnati specialized in butchering hogs, it was known as Porkopolis, and one of Findlay's duties was to provision riverboats with ham, bacon, and sausage. One day, after Findlay had loaded a boat bound for New Orleans with 70 salted carcasses, the satisfied captain paid him, then uttered a name Findlay had not heard before. "We find ourselves with extra cargo space, McNab. Could you scurry about and find us some bolts of cloth? Doesn't have to be fancy stuff, because it'll be transshipped to Texas." "Where's that?" "Surely you've heard of Texas. Garden spot of the continent." "Where is it?" "Part of Mexico now, but not for long." "What do you mean?" "Texas is the ass end of Mexico, which don't give a damn for it. Each trip I make down the Mississippi, I carry men from Kentucky and Tennessee who's going to Texas. Stands to reason that with their long rifles, they ain't gonna be Mexicans for very long. They's gonna bring Texas into the Union, and the sooner the better, I say." "Why do people go there?" Findlay asked. "To get rich. You plant cotton, it explodes in your face. You plant corn, you get two crops a year. Cows have twins in Texas, it's the law. And you get a league and a labor, that's why." "What are they?" "A league is 4,428 acres of pasture land. You get it free for cattle. A labor is 177 acres of better land you get for farming, also free." "I can't believe it." "You get it the minute you step across the border and say, 'What's your name? Findlay McNab?' When you step up and say, 'Here I am, Findlay McNab,' you get all those acres of the best land in America." "You said it was Mexico." "It'll soon be America, you can count on that." McNab asked so many questions about Texas that he became known along the waterfront as a prospective settler. And one day, a Mr. Clendenning invited him to lunch aboard one of the steamboats docked at the wharves. "Can I bring my son?" Findlay asked. "He dreams about steamboats." "To be sure," Clendenning said expansively. And when they were seated in the spacious dining salon, with its gold and silver ornamentations, the stranger told Otto, "This is how we live on the great boats, sonny." "Do you live here?" "Up and down." "You live on the river?" "For the time being." "How long?" "Until I visited all the ports of call." He now explained to Findlay that he was the traveling representative of the Texas Land and Improvement Company, headquartered in Boston, and his pleasant task was to sell future immigrants to Texas the best bargain this weary old world had ever seen. Pushing away the dinner plates, he spread an interesting series of documents on the table and said, "This is scrip, authorized by the Mexican government and fully backed by the Texas Land and Improvement Company of Boston, Massachusetts. Each unit of scrip you buy entitles you to 1 acre of the choicest land in North America. Buy yourself 3,000 or 4,000 units, and you're set for life." "Did you say buy?" "Yes. You deliver this scrip to the Mexican officials, and presto, they invite you to go out and survey your 3,000 or 4,000 acres." "I was told I would get a league and a labor free, something like 4,000 acres." "No, no. You're entitled to the league and a labor, and it's there waiting for you. But you have to bring the scrip to prove your legality. My firm vouches for you, says you're of good character, and you get the land." McNabb felt deflated. For some days now he had been visualizing his 4,000 acres of choice land, his for the asking. And now, to find that he must buy something in order to qualify was disheartening. He supposed the cost per acre would be something like a dollar or two, and so large a debt he would not be able to manage. "How much is this scrip?" "$0.05 an acre." Clendenning, noticing the relief in his prospect's face, said heartily, "That's what I said. That's what I meant. 5 cents an acre, just to make it legal." While Finley was congratulating himself on such a bargain, Clendenning added encouragingly, "So what our more responsible customers do, they put up $1,000 and get title to 20,000 acres. Then they are really in business." "Can I get so much?" "Dear friend, Mexico wants you to come. They want you to settle their vast empty spaces. You can have 40,000 acres if you wish, but I've been recommending only 20, more manageable." "Have you been there? Have you seen the land?" "McNabb, do you know the passage in the Holy Book, 'A land flowing with milk and honey'? Someday we'll find that a man from Texas wrote the Bible, for that describes the land precisely. One day I was walking beside the Trinity River, marvelous stream, and what did I see? A shattered old tree whose insides were filled with honeybees, millions of them. There was enough honey in there to feed a regiment. And right beside that tree, one of the sturdiest cows ever you saw, aching to give milk. A land flowing with honey and milk, just like the Bible says." "How many acres would you go for if you were me?" The salesman did not answer. Instead, he turned to Otto, and with a benign look suffusing his face, said, "I would think only of my son. If I could get 20,000 acres securely in my hands, and improve it, when I died I would leave this lad," and here he stroked Otto's head, "a fortune of incalculable wealth." In the pause which followed this sensible advice, he smiled at Otto, then added, "Can you imagine your son at age 20, with his bride at his side, taking command of a farm of 20,000 acres? The cattle, the fields of corn, the faithful slaves working the cotton? And you sitting on the porch, surveying it all like a proud patriarch in the Old Testament?"